From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
It's now or never for a divided Republican Party. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. The White House says President Trump will watch and take names as House Speaker Paul Ryan tries to unite the GOP to repeal and replace Obamacare. Meantime, polls show more than half the public's opposed to adding some 24 million people to the ranks of the uninsured. The House is scheduled to vote later today, and we'll look at the consequences one way or the other. Will the president blame the speaker if the bill fails? If it passes the House, what's its chance in the Senate? There's a lot at stake, including the health of America's health care system. Later on today's Talking Point, can the Great Barrier Reef be revived? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, I'm Armin Olney, back with To the Point. President Trump has demanded a House vote today on replacing Obamacare, whatever the details might be. Despite his campaign promise that nobody would lose health insurance, that would be possible for 24 million people if he were finally to sign this bill into law. Today's talking point, Australia's Great Barrier Reef is not just one of the world's great wonders, it's also food and livelihood for hundreds of millions of people. Now one quarter of it has been killed by warming oceans. Is there any hope for revival? First, this news update. Today's public hearing by the House Intelligence Committee, or Tuesday's, rather, has been canceled by Republican Chairman Devin Nunes. Obama intelligence officials had been scheduled to testify. Nunes was asked about including new witnesses.
We're not going to get into a neo-McCarthyism era here where we just start bringing in Americans because they were mentioned in a press story, and I am highly concerned about that.
Now, the Obama administration officials, James Clapper, Director of Intelligence, John Brennan, CIA, and Sally Yates with the Justice Department, were all scheduled to testify. Eric Geller is cybersecurity reporter following this story for Politico. Hi, Eric. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What is Nunes trying to do here? And I take it he wants to have the former director of the FBI, the current director of the FBI and the NSA come back again and testify, this time in a closed hearing.
That's right. It's still unclear exactly what prompted this, but he did say that they want Director Comey and Director Rogers to brief them in a private setting where the public can't watch to discuss apparently some sensitive information related to the Russian investigation. The committee has been, of course, going out to the agencies and reading documents related to those agencies' work, so it's entirely possible that they came across documents that the chairman said required Director Comey and Director Rogers to come in. But right now, he has not fully explained exactly what prompted this change.
Obviously, the Trump people took a lot of heat after Comey and Rogers testified in public. Does it appear the Republicans were concerned that if Clapper, Brennan, and Yates all testified in public, too, that might be another negative round of news?
It's very hard to say. Certainly, you can imagine that unless the Monday hearing was just the witnesses making things up out of thin air, that certainly other former senior officials who had access to that same information would probably paint not much better of a picture. So you can certainly imagine that things wouldn't go that much better. It's still unclear whether that is particularly the reason why we had this change.
The Democrats, of course, are trying to portray this as partisan action. Here is Nunes. A Democratic counterpart, the ranking member Adam Schiff.
We really do need an independent commission here because the public at the end of the day needs to have confidence that someone has done a thorough investigation untainted by political considerations.
So, Eric Geller, back to you. How long might it take the FBI if the House Intelligence Committee can't get its act together to complete its investigation? Nobody knows.
That's right. Counterintelligence investigations can take years. I mean, they essentially have to try to figure out if they can recommend charges to the Justice Department, which requires, you know, obviously a courtroom standard of proof. And in a lot of these cases, they are looking at intercepts and perhaps even primary source documents, if they're able to get them, that are piecework, piecemeal, I should say. This is not the kind of situation that you would like to have if you were an FBI agent trying to help prosecutors build a case. So this could very well take years.
If there were to be an independent commission, as Adam Schiff is calling for, who would appoint it?
Well, Congress would have to essentially set the charter. They would have to pass legislation that establishes, at the very least, the structure. And I would assume that they would get to pick the individual members, or perhaps they would have a chairman and a vice chairman, and those individuals could pick the members. But certainly Congress would have to initiate that process.
Much attention had been paid, of course, to the former chairman of the Trump campaign, Paul Manafort. Nunes apparently said today that Manafort had offered to testify to the committee, but he wants to do it behind closed doors. What would they want to ask him?
Well, they could want him to corroborate some of the information that is classified or otherwise hidden. And so that could be a reason to do this in private. I mean, you can't exactly ask them to corroborate classified information in a public setting. They could also potentially offer some sort of arrangement where if he agrees to testify, they will keep it private, hoping that he will be more candid.
There has, of course, been an AP story this week. We heard about it on our program that Manafort made millions of dollars over the years from a very pro-Vladimir Putin oligarch in Russia. Much of the work he did was in Ukraine, but in other former Soviet republics as well.
That's right. And I think what this does is it just adds to the reasons that you see Democrats pushing for an independent investigation, because right now it's not exactly clear that there is direct evidence of anything approaching collusion. But if, you know, Adam Schiff, the top Democrat, starts to see more of a reason for that, you can imagine him continuing to be uncomfortable with his chairman based on what we saw this week.
So what's next for the hearings?
Well, as you noted, the public hearing on Tuesday has been canceled. There is a Senate hearing next Thursday, and that is expected to be setting the table, if you will, for Russian activities. It's not expected to bring in Obama administration witnesses, but I do expect that we will see this House hearing at the very least rescheduled. And, you know, we're just going to have to see exactly what lawmakers say after that closed briefing on Tuesday, whether the Democrats continue to push for some sort of big change to the investigation.
All right. A lot of action going on there, and a lot of partisanship once again. In a hearing that supposedly was going to be bipartisan. Apparently, not much hope for that. Eric Geller, good to talk with you as always.
Thank you.
Cybersecurity reporter for Politico, following this extraordinary story. In a moment, it's now or never for a divided Republican Party. On To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Olney back with To the Point. President Trump has given Republicans in Congress an ultimatum. Pass the so-called American Health Care Act this afternoon or continue to live with Obamacare, despite 7 years of promises to repeal and replace it. House Speaker Ryan went to the White House today, reportedly to tell the president he just doesn't have the votes. Here's White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
There's no question, in my mind at least, that the president and the team have left everything on the field. We have called every member that had a question or a concern, tried to the extent possible, take into consideration ideas that would strengthen the bill, and it's now going to be up to the members of the House to decide whether or not they want to follow through on the promise of that. But we're going to continue to work with the Speaker and the leadership there to see, you know, where the votes are.
As we go on the air, the debate is continuing. Here is David Hawkins. He's senior editor at Roll Call, writes the blog and column called Hawkins Here. Great to have you back on our show, as always.
Thank you, Warren.
So does it appear that the White House is, in fact, going to be able to blame Paul Ryan, or going to take the position that he was at fault, if, in fact, this bill doesn't pass?
Well, you know, the president can do as he pleases, and he certainly has a track record of blaming others for his own political and legislative limitations so far in his national career. Paul Ryan is back at the Capitol. I'm in the Capitol. I'm come back in. He didn't take any questions. Certainly, it was probably good visuals for the speaker to be the one to go down to the White House and inform the president that the votes aren't there. In fact, the vote count is getting worse for the Republicans by the hour, not better. CQ roll calls count, I think, is up to 34 no or solidly leaning no votes. And, of course, they can afford to lose no more than 22. So at this point, they're 12 short of what they need, and the numbers are getting worse, including, the guy who is arguably the chairman of the most prominent committee on the House, Rodney Frelinghuysen of New Jersey, announced this morning that he was going to vote no. So it's not just – these are not just backbench iconoclasts. This is now a prominent member of the leadership voting no.
And here's an interesting tweet from a conservative Republican from Kentucky, Thomas Massey. If exec branch tells legislative branch when to vote, how to vote, and what it will be allowed to work on if vote fails, is that a republic? So there's obviously some concern about White House involvement.
Well, I think that there's concern about White House involvement because the White House involvement doesn't seem to be working. I think if the president had twisted some arms and forced the issue and pulled them over the goal line, he'd be being hailed as the guy who wrote the art of the deal and made it pay off for him in his first big test in Congress. But now, and of course, we should note that Mr. Massey is dead set against this bill. So it is not, he's not only annoyed at Mr. Trump on sort of procedural and balance of power grounds, but he doesn't like this bill to begin with. I think you're right that we are now already beginning the blame gaming is already sort of starting to bubble up. I'm sitting here right off the House floor, which is fascinating because there are several dozen House Democrats just sitting in the chamber watching this all unfold, and only if watching as the Republicans sort of come in one by one to give their speeches. And you can just sort of, I mean, you can't see them smelling the blood in the water, but that's certainly that's the body language they're giving off. I've been doing this for 30 years. I have never, I really am struggling to recall another time where the leadership of the majority was going to put a bill on the floor that they were so really confident didn't have the votes to pass.
Interesting that Sean Spicer said, too, today that this isn't a dictatorship, suggesting that the president can't force people to vote for something they don't want to vote for. There had been some thought that they might cancel the vote. Why do you suppose they didn't?
Well, they did postpone it for one day. It was originally going to be yesterday, which they had scheduled for symbolic reasons because it was the 7th anniversary of the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. And then it was clear that they didn't have the votes yesterday. And then the White House, it was the White House that told the leadership, we want to vote and we want to rip the Band-Aid off here. We've negotiated as much as we're going to negotiate, which is interesting to me because it's been less than 3 weeks, really, that they've been talking about this bill. We're through negotiating. We want the vote and we want to call the question and force members in the White House's view to decide, do you want to keep Obamacare or do you want my bill, the Donald Trump bill? And then he says he's going to move on. And the president, has already sort of started talking about tax overhaul today and really sort of trying to essentially already look beyond this.
Why is it that it has to happen, that it's now or never? What's the urgency of it?
Well, there's both political urgency and there is procedural urgency. The political urgency is, of course, they've been promising to do this for 7 years.
Sure.
And this is the first thing. The procedural urgency is, it's a little bit wonky, but essentially every time Congress can agree on a budget, they can agree on one bill to try and enact that budget with sort of magical powers, especially in the Senate. It would be a bill that is free from filibuster in the Senate. But there's certain timetables for getting that done, and there's only really one chance to do it. In other words, if this is their so-called reconciliation bill, this is their budget reconciliation bill, it has these magical powers because it promises to cut the deficit by some amount. But if it is defeated, they cannot write a new one and put it before the House, without the senator saying, sorry, you took your one chance, you tried your one budget reconciliation bill, and it failed. So no, we are not going to give you filibuster-proof procedures when this bill comes to the Senate. So that's why it's procedurally now or never.
All right, David Hawkins, once again at Roll Call, a veteran of many years of covering the Congress, says he's never seen anything like this. Jeffrey Young is a senior reporter at the Huffington Post. He covers health care and politics. And Jeffrey Young, good to have you with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We heard a moment ago that the Democrats are just sitting there watching. Presumably they're not taking notes. What is the tone among them now? Do they have some sense of victory about this?
Well, my colleagues, Sam Stein and Amanda Turkle, have a good story about that very thing up on the Huffington Post today. And the gist is that, you know, obviously the minority party in this case and the party that wrote the Affordable Care Act is getting some kind of bitter pleasure out of watching Republicans struggle to undo it. At the same time, though, you know, what they told my colleagues, of course, is that they don't like this anyway because they want the healthcare system to be better. And, you know, everybody from Barack Obama to Hillary Clinton to Nancy Pelosi will tell you that in the years that the Affordable Care Act has been in place, you know, some deficiencies have become apparent that need to be addressed through legislation. This bill that looks at this point to be doomed, although who knows, in the House from Republicans wasn't intended to do that. It was intended to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and kind of replace it with something smaller. But, you know, so they're worried about the healthcare system, even while they're, you know, kind of darkly amused watching their Republican counterparts flounder on this issue.
There's an interesting poll out today. I'm not entirely sure who does it, but it's called the Trump Country Poll, and apparently involves 220 counties that went for Obama and then for Trump. And among that population, apparently only 43% support this bill. 43% support it, 46% oppose it. How important is that, do you think, to the Republicans who have to run again in 2018?
I mean, I have to assume that, you know, seeing polls like that, and of course, if you remember, it wasn't very long ago that a lot of these Republicans went home to have town hall meetings and were kind of surprised at the level of vehemence their constituents were exhibiting to them about health care and the president's and campaign's possible ties to the Russian government and a bunch of other issues. You know, they seem to be taken aback by that because these are their voters also. You know, I think for people who voted for Trump, you know, not to attempt to mind read, and everyone's different, of course, but, you know, on the campaign trail, when the president talked about health care, he didn't talk about the bill that's in the House right now that would, you know, make it so insurance companies didn't have to cover hospitalizations anymore if they didn't want to. He talked about it's going to be better. It's going to be much better. It's going to be much less expensive. The deductibles in Obamacare are too high. We're going to fix that, and on and on and on. This bill doesn't actually do any of those things. And I have a hunch anyway that a lot of those folks, those 47% of people in that particular poll who did not say that they liked this bill, maybe that message has gotten through to them. And not to mention, a lot has been made of the fact that, you know, according to the Congressional Budget Office and some other outside analyses of this bill, it would result in the kind of older, rural, lower-income people who, you know, a lot of data suggests help propel the president into the White House, it would hurt them the most. So if you are one of those folks and you heard that, you know, probably you wouldn't like the bill either.
Interesting that Breitbart today has a headline, Bannon, of course, meaning Steve Bannon, now the president's closest advisor, privately pans Ryan Bill. Sally Pipes is with us, president, CEO, and fellow in healthcare policy at the Pacific Research Institute. Her latest book is The Way Out of Obamacare, conservative voice on our program. Sally Pipes, good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Did the president overpromise in this regard and create expectations among the people who voted for him that he's simply not able to put together?
Well, I think, you know, in the election and just a week before the election, when those high premiums came out, average at about 22% to 25%, some were a lot higher, he said, you know, in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, that, you know, I'm going to you know, repeal and replace disastrous Obamacare. And I think that is one of the main reasons why he won in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. And, you know, he made that promise to the American people. So, you know, we kept thinking that he was going to bring out his own bill in the last few weeks. He kept saying he was going to. But in the end, when the American Health Care Act came out, he said he was going to stick by that. And it's slightly different, the American Health Care Act, than what Paul Ryan in his A Better Way plan had, and also what Dr. Tom Price had in his Empowering Patients First Act. So, you know, it's the American Health Care Act is, as I say, it's slightly different. There are some very good things in it. There are some bad things in it. How the vote will go today, I mean, we're waiting for another hour to see what happens. A lot of the people, you know, that are being interviewed say it's going to go down. I actually think it might pass, but you know, but who knows? It's been a very nerve-wracking time, and you know, Chris Wallace on Fox said it's probably one of the most exciting times that he's seen since he's been watching things in Washington.
It depends what excites you what doesn't, I guess. You mentioned Dr. Tom Price. He's, of course, former congressman from Georgia, now head of the Department of Health and Human Services, and very much involved in administering such things as health care. David Hawkins, I want to go back to you again with roll call. What do you think's going on here? Is the White House trying to embarrass Ryan now and say that even though they backed his bill, it really wasn't Trump's bill after all? They were trying to leave it up to him. And will they be able to step back and say this is something that he wasn't able to pull off?
So I would have thought that was coming until just a few minutes before we went on the air. You know, Sean, the quote of the day from Sean Spicer's briefing was that the president believes that he and the White House, quote, left everything on the table going after this bill. You know, having said that, I mean, again, you know, the president sometimes says without any worry two contradictory things quite close together. But the fact that Spicer went out to say left everything on the table seems to make it more difficult to plausibly say later in the day, this wasn't our idea. Ryan wanted us to do this, you know, and it wasn't a good bill. And it's also, I think, it's pretty incontrovertible that they're having this vote this afternoon, so-called burning their ships, as the Republican whip Steve Scalise said last night. You know, burning the ships, having the vote one way or the other. That was at the president's request. This was not a strategic decision that really any congressional leader would have made on his own absent presidential influence.
So, Sally Pipes, back to you. After 7 years of saying this was terrible legislation, we want to repeal and replace it. If they don't repeal and replace it, what are the consequences, do you think, for the Republican Party?
Well, I mean, this is definitely, I think, going to have a major impact on the 2018 votes, both for the House and the Senate. But, I mean, if this does go down today in an hour, I think, you know, there's a couple of things. One, Dr. Tom Price, as we just said, Secretary of HHS, has a number of issues that can be repealed through administrative action or executive order. And one of the main things he has said is the Essential Health Benefit Plan. The other thing is that, you know, Congress can vote on specific aspects of the bill. I mean, some of the things some Democrats, the Republicans in the Senate may get, you know, 60, 61 votes on a couple of things, such as the ability of insurance companies to sell coverage across state lines. That's something where there is a lot more sort of bipartisan support for. But the real issue is, I mean, a few weeks ago, President Trump said, well, you know, maybe we should just let Obamacare die. It's in a death spiral and we'll see what happens, and then we'll blame the Dems, you know, for this. But I think the big issue is if it doesn't, you know, go to the Senate, and if it doesn't pass in the Senate through with, you know, 51 senators, I think, you know, there is a real threat and problem that we could see Obamacare forever. It may be very, very difficult. And as my former mentor, Milton Friedman, said, when you get an entitlement program, even if it's not working for the American people, very difficult to get rid of.
Sally Pipes, once again, author of The Way Out of Obamacare, president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute. We're going to come back and continue this conversation on our talking point later. Can the Great Barrier Reef be revived? We'll hear what's happening there. Back in a moment with To the Point. This is produced by Public Radio International. Warren Olney here, host of To the Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To The Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life. Warren Olney back with To The Point. Once again, the vote is expected very soon on the bill to repeal and replace Obamacare. We are talking about the prospects for it. It is thought at the moment to be in some trouble, although Sally Pipes seems to think that maybe they can pull it off. In any case, we're talking about the consequences one way or the other, and the issues, regardless of the outcome, do in many ways remain the same. Sarah Gollist is with us. She's a professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, studies the intersection of communications and politics and health policy. All of those are part of our program. Good to talk with you.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
We heard a moment ago from Sally Pipes that Tom Price, now head of Health and Human Services, former congressman, of course, that he could, by executive actions, get rid of some aspects of Obamacare, including what are referred to as the essential health benefits. A lot of people think that would be effectively sabotaging Obamacare. What do you say?
Yeah. Well, the essential health benefits are one of a bundle of policy tools that are in the Affordable Care Act, and they're all kind of intricately linked together. I mean, as we're getting closer, as we're at this repeal moment, it's kind of like taking apart a clock and you realize what's in it. So there's a lot of what's in the ACA that depends on one another, and the essential health benefits is a great example of that. So if you don't have the essential health benefits, and so someone, say, with diabetes goes to purchase a plan, and a plan is not required to sell them a plan that includes prescription drug coverage, for instance, then they are effectively paying more for having diabetes. And so that goes against that aspect of the law that has pretty broad-based support, the requirement to sell plans to people with pre-existing conditions. So that's one example. Another example that's in the ACA that would essentially fall apart or become meaningless without the essential health benefits provision is the ban on insurance companies from enacting annual or lifetime maximum payments. So, for instance, a child is born and needs an intensive time in the neonatal intensive care unit for some weeks or months. In the pre-ACA days, if a person was on an individual or small business insurance plan, they might get capped in their insurance while that baby is still in the hospital 2-3 months in. And under the ACA, that's no longer the case. But that provision of the law only applies to those essential covered benefits of, in this case, hospitalization. So you can see that it would be a pretty significant domino effect to change one or the other piece of the law through that process.
On the other hand, there's an argument that the essential health benefits, which include pregnancy services and maternity services, newborn care, mental health issues, would apply to people and they'd have to pay for them, even though they didn't want them or didn't need them. Sally Pipes, explain that argument, if you will.
Right. So the essential benefit plan, the 10 points that are in there and the things that you just mentioned. I mean, one of the things, this was another layer of increased premium costs on health care and through the Affordable Care Act. We have to remember that there are about 2,100 mandates on health insurance companies across the country at the state level. Most states have, 45 to 50 mandates on what insurers must cover anyway. And so I see the essential benefit plan as really one of the reasons why a lot of the young people, the young invincibles, I'm no longer in that group, who, decided to pay the individual mandate penalty of $695 or 2.5% of income, whichever is greater, because they didn't want to buy a plan that cost much more than they were willing to pay, and the reason being because of these essential benefits. Young people, they want a plan that would, for the most part, they're going to be healthy, that would cover catastrophic events. But this essential benefit plan made it very difficult for young people to make the decision to buy health coverage. And so when you look at getting rid of the essential benefit plan, my hope is that a lot of insurance companies and new innovators, America is a great innovative country, would introduce new types of plans that would have different different plans. So if I want a plan that has alcohol rehabilitation, I should be able to get it. But Warren, you may not want that, so you shouldn't have to pay for it. But people should be able to get the kind of coverage at a cost that they want to pay. And these mandates really push up the cost of premiums. And we've seen, you know, as I say, that only 28% of the young invincibles bought coverage. And the problem was it should have been 40%. So the older people who were sicker, of course, put a lot of pressure on those insurance companies. And now we're seeing a number of them say, well, you know, Humana said they're not going to participate in the exchanges at all next year, regardless of what happens to the ACA. Aetna cut out of a number of exchanges, United did, because they were losing money on their exchange plans.
So, Sarah Golis, what do you say to that? It also means that, for example, men of whatever age would have to pay for insurance for maternity benefits. And it's pointed out that men don't have babies. How do you respond to that and to what we just heard from Ms. Pipes?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think the basic issue with health is that in many cases, so we can set aside the maternity care example for a moment, health risks are really unanticipated. Nobody wants to get sick. No one plans to get sick. I come from a public health perspective. We don't know what emergent infections or viruses or national epidemics might be on the horizon. So it's very, very hard for an individual to predict the specific type of health needs they're going to encounter when, you know, we as a population don't know what's around the corner in terms of some of the public health threats. So I think that's one important point to consider when we think about what should be kind of an essential floor or minimum types of services that people should have. As for the maternity care coverage issue, well, certainly a man above reproductive age is not going to use this service. But I think that ignores the societal importance of having a healthy family and healthy babies. And also, I mean, saying that men's coverage should be different from women's suggests that sort of the needs that men have are the norm or the right ones, and what women have are extra or special, and women are 50% of the population. And I think my final point on that is just that even for women, pregnancy can be unanticipated. We know in public health that 50% of all pregnancies are unplanned through a variety of reasons. And so pregnancy itself is an unanticipated event that's hard to plan for. So I think that very nature of the unpredictability of health events is what supports having some essential benefits and coverage across states and localities.
A little bit of background and context. Sean Spicer said yesterday that older men don't need newborn care. It turns out that when his latest child was born, Donald Trump was 59 years old. There also is a photograph that was taken, I believe, yesterday, showing Vice President Pence and the House Freedom Caucus all talking about men not needing maternity care. Sally Pipes, everybody in that picture was a white male. What does that say to you about the way that these decisions are being made?
Well, I think, you know, there have been a lot of people who have been doing a lot of work on this of all different types and, different nationalities, different males, females, whatever. I mean, if you look back at the Affordable Care Act, look at the people who were the architects, Zeke Emanuel, Jonathan Gruber, Mr. Bob Kocher. I mean, you know, these are all the males that were involved in setting up the Affordable Care Act for passage, which, of course, not one Republican voted for it. And, of course, at the time, Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, from San Francisco, where I am from, said we have to pass this bill so we can find out what's in it. It took a while for the American people to find out what's in it. And when you look at the high premiums, the very high deductibles that a lot of people have coverage in the exchange, but they can't afford to use it, insurance companies getting out, 19 of the 23 co-ops failing them, and then the fact that the networks of doctors and hospitals for many people who bought the exchange coverage were very small, and people found out they couldn't use the doctor that they had before, or they couldn't use the hospital that they were used to. So I think it's not a sexist thing. It's about who are the best people in the research area to develop, you know, a healthcare plan. And I'm a female, and I've been very involved in this for many, many years, going back to when I lived in Canada.
Jeffrey Young, back to you, senior reporter at the Huffington Post, covering healthcare and politics, a part of the first part of our program. It has been argued that without all of these benefits, the The so-called essential health benefits, all 10 of them, we haven't listed them all, but they're all pretty important, that if you don't have all of those things, then as Sarah Golust mentioned, since you can't anticipate what's going to happen, you might get health insurance that's pretty cheap, but it might not end up covering what goes wrong.
Yeah, Warren, I have to be blunt. This whole idea of a la carte insurance is baffling to me. If you are choosing benefits from an insurance company, for example, if you go to buy a plan and you say, I would like to add maternity coverage, well, they know you're going to have a baby. They're going to charge you a lot of money for it. If you say, I would like prescription drug coverage, they know you're going to get prescription drugs, so they're going to charge you for it. To me, the mere concept is akin to you telling an auto insurer, I want to make sure I have collision coverage because I plan on crashing this car into a wall. It just doesn't work.
What do you say to that, Sally Pipes?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, in healthcare, that we really need to, you know, have plans that suit individual needs. And younger people, for sure, you know, don't have as many, you know, health issues as older people. And as we've seen, that they did not purchase coverage on the exchanges. But
what about the argument about the a la carte insurances policies and that, as was just suggested, if you ask for insurance for certain things, it's going to drive up the cost because the insurance company will know you must be worried about it.
Well, different people are going to have to pay different prices for coverage, but this people should be able to get this kind of coverage that suits their needs and their own needs or those of their families. And so, you know, 5 million people lost their plans when the you know, under the Affordable Care Act because they didn't fit the essential benefit plan. But that was really at the detriment of a lot of people that, you know, wanted a skinny plan or wanted a short-term plan or whatever. So I think, you know, we really need to open up the market. And one of the big issues is the insurance companies. There are really five major insurance companies. Aetna tried to buy Humana. Anthem tried to buy Cigna. It would have made the market even smaller. We need to have a healthcare market that opens up so that there are many new types of innovations. And look at what Silicon Valley has done. Look at Uber. Look at Airbnb. We do not have a market in healthcare at all. 50% of healthcare in this country is in the hands of government. And we need more competition, not less, because that's what will make it better for all Americans.
All right. Let me go back to David Hawkins again from the first part of our program, senior editor at Roll Call, author of Hawkins Here. He is in the House of Congress at the moment watching the debate that is going on, leading up to the vote that is planned to happen very soon, but unfortunately after we have to end this program. What about the Senate? And if this bill passes, particularly if it doesn't have the essential health benefits in it, what are its chances in the upper house?
Zero. And actually already today, Mitch McConnell had said up until this morning, the Senate Majority Leader,
sure,
that he wanted to put this the Senate's version of the health care bill on the Senate floor next week. He has now changed his mind, said whatever they do will be after the spring break, that they want to put the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court ahead of this. But yes, the odds that Senate Republicans would all hold together and vote for a bill that would only get over the threshold because it was sort of pushed to the Freedom Caucus right in order to get through are zero. There are plenty of Republicans. There are a couple of Republicans who are on that sort of Tea Party Freedom Caucus side, like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. But more importantly, are the Republicans who, like Rob Portman of Ohio and Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who are still sort of what old school centrists and believe that their constituents have benefited from many of the things that this bill would take away. So I would say it's highly unlikely. Now, that doesn't prevent them from writing their own bill, and this is sort of the way we all studied in civics class, which is the way it's supposed to work, which is the House passes one version of a bill. The Senate can then pass a very different version of a bill, and then they are supposed to get together and try and find a common ground between them. So that seems to be part of what the Trump message is to House Republicans today is don't kill the process now. Vote for this as a first bid, and then we can come back and fix it in the end. But many Republicans do not want to be on the record voting for things that they'll get pilloried for in their next campaigns for voting for, and then won't become part of the final law.
We had somebody on the program the other day who said in a very optimistic way that sometimes partisanship fails and then bipartisanship takes over and succeeds. Given the importance of health care, David Hawking, is there any chance that might happen?
That is a great sentiment. I think that there are no Democrats that I know of in either the House or the Senate that have any interest in replacing Obamacare. When the law was enacted 7 years ago, there were still crucial blocks of sort of centrist and conservative-leaning Democrats, some of whom voted against Obamacare. They have essentially all been replaced, most of them by more conservative Republicans. So that there is no on this issue. There is no bipartisan consensus. The Democrats want to stick with the status quo, and the Republicans all say they don't like the status quo. They just haven't figured out what they'd like better.
Sarah Gaulis, very quickly, a basic question. How did we get here? Did the Obama administration and the Democrats do a pretty bad job of promoting this bill and what might be good about it from the beginning?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think it stems from the fact that, as Sally mentioned, not a single Republican voted for the ACA. And as a result, it had such a strong, polarized, politically partisan flavor from the get-go. The Democrats moving into the midterms were pretty reluctant in their messaging, in their campaign ads, and in their rhetoric to embrace the fact that they had supported the ACA. And we saw that going forward. In my research, I've looked at how the television news media covered the ACA during the initial implementation, and much of the news coverage was about the politics and the political disagreements and not about the substance of the law. So consumers and the American public didn't hear all that much about what was in the law during its early implementation. They heard about the politics. And so that politically charged flavor of the law is what I think stayed with the public rather than really what does the law do? And we see that the highest support for the law is right now at present, as people are becoming very worried about the prospect of it getting taken away.
Very quickly, Jeffrey Young, last question to you, senior reporter at the Huffington Post. Given the involvement of President Trump at the last minute to trying to get this bill passed, does it suggest that he is not really the artist of the deal after all, and might that charge be made against him?
Well, it's already being made. But it's a fair question to ask, because this is the first real effort that this White House and this new president have made with the Congress of their own party to do something big. And right now, anyway, it looks like it's going to fall flat. Maybe they'll pull something out. You know, I don't like to say never, because sometimes Congress surprises you. But, you know, this was supposed to be his thing. You know, I think it was, I can't remember if it was the White House or someone on Capitol Hill yesterday, they called the president the closer. Well, if your closer comes in and doesn't get the job done, they call it blown.
Okay, Jeffrey Young, again, a senior reporter at the Huffington Post. Thanks a lot for being with us. Sally Pipes at the Pacific Research Institute, author of The Way Out of Obamacare. Thanks to you as well. Not convinced, as I understand it, that this bill is necessarily going to fail. David Hawkings, once again, at the Congress, watching the debate. He'll be watching the vote as well, senior editor at Roll Call. And Sarah Gaulis, professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Thank you all very much for being on our program. We'll see what happens. This conversation will still be worth listening to, whatever the vote might be. Thank you all once again for being with us. In a moment, one of the world's great living wonders is dying fast. Can the Great Barrier Reef be revived? This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Allen here with today's Talking Point. Australia's Great Barrier Reef is hundreds of miles of tiny creatures, corals, that are exquisitely sensitive to changes in ocean temperatures. In recent years, seas overheated by less than 2 degrees have killed an estimated 1/4 of this magnificent world wonder. Mark Aiken is coordinator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Coral Reef Watch Program. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thanks for having me on, Warren.
Tell us what bleaching is and what it's doing to the Great Barrier Reef.
So first of all, corals are animal, vegetable, and mineral. So the coral animal has microscopic algae, the vegetable part, living inside their tissues. And the combination of the two allows them to build the skeletons that form the reefs. When that relationship between the plant and the animal breaks down, it causes the coral to have to expel the algae, leaving them clear. You can see the skeleton. That's why it looks bleached, but it's still alive. But it's very sick, very injured, and the coral is starving at that point. When an event like this scale happens, where you have large areas of overwarm water that causes bleaching over hundreds to thousands of miles, it's going to just cause a breakdown in the ecosystem, so that corals are dying. They're starting to actually get eroded, and the reefs are starting to collapse. It affects the fish and it affects the people.
Tell us about the people.
Well, about 500 million people around the world, at least, rely on coral reefs as their primary food source for the fish that come from them, as well as shellfish and such. They rely on them for income from things like tourism and fishing. They rely on them for coastal protection. Reefs protect shorelines from waves, as well as they break down, the reefs produce sand. So these are not just something that is a destination for a lot of people. This is their life.
So this isn't only the Great Barrier Reef, but it is, of course, this gigantic world wonder. I said it's hundreds of miles. How many miles long is it, and how much of it is dead? How much of it is threatened?
Oh, I forget exactly how much. It's over 1,000 miles long. It's a huge set of reefs going all along the coast of Australia. And the area that was hit the worst last year during the record-setting bleaching event, the northern part, almost all the reefs were bleached. They had two-thirds of the corals in the northern part died. The bleaching extended throughout almost all of the reef from top to bottom, although not too bad in the central portion of the Great Barrier Reef and not much at all in the southern portion. This year, though, we're seeing bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef again, and some of the worst that they're seeing is in the central area, where we're losing a lot of the corals that were only somewhat stressed last year.
Has this already had an impact on the people who need the reef for food, for the tourism business, and for coastal protection?
Absolutely. I mean, the tourism impacts on the Great Barrier Reef were not as big last year because it was mostly in the far north where there's less tourists. But those were actually some of the most pristine reefs. The central and southern part that had been hit previously by local impacts such as overfishing, pollution, and so forth, as well as prior bleaching events, you know, those weren't in as good a shape, but at least, you know, we're doing well for the tourists. This new bleaching that's going on now, of course, is hitting some of the key reefs in the central part.
You've mentioned pollution and overfishing in addition to the warming of the oceans. If, in fact, the pollution were to be cleaned up and the fisheries restored, would that be enough to save the Great Barrier Reef?
Well, not necessarily to save it on its own. In fact, not at all. What it would do is it would allow the corals to be able to recover faster if they're given an opportunity. But what we found in the study that just came out in Nature is that last year's event was so big that overfished reefs or unfished reefs, polluted, unpolluted, they were all being affected the same by the heating. And so if we don't deal with the basic issue, which is climate change, then those local factors alone are not enough.
How long does the reef have, do you think, those parts of it that aren't already bleached or bleaching?
Well, it's hard to say for the Great Barrier Reef alone. I mean, this is a global problem that's going on. And in fact, the bleaching that we saw in the Great Barrier Reef last year and this year is part of a global bleaching event that's been going on since June of 2014. It's unprecedented in its size, its scope, and its duration. The climate models indicate we may have 15, 30 years before we start seeing bleaching happening on a regular basis. So we really need to be dealing with reducing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now to be able to get to where the reefs are going to survive into the future.
You, once again, are a coordinator of the Reef Watch Program at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. In the budget currently proposed by the Trump administration, how are you doing?
Well, that's a good question. We haven't seen the detailed budget, and of course this is just a proposal, and Congress has to act on it. But the portion of NOAA that we operate in, which is the satellite service, is slated for $500 million cut. Basically, that's the cost of the next weather satellite. And we rely on those satellites to do what we do, as well as to bring you your weather forecasts, your hurricane forecasts, all of those. So we're concerned.
So those things, plus your ability to study things like the Great Barrier Reef and other reefs around the world and determine what's happening to them.
Absolutely.
So you're doing the best you can, obviously, and as you indicated, you know, every budget is said to be dead on arrival, but you never know what's going to happen, particularly when proposals like that are made. Are you, though, given the 15 or 30-year time period you gave the Great Barrier Reef, despairing at this point? Do you think that there's any chance that we could actually reduce global warming sufficiently to save the reef?
If I didn't think there was a chance, I wouldn't keep working so hard on this. It's not a lost cause. But it's going to take some serious efforts. We're going to have to really move on climate change. We're going to have to move toward a fossil fuel-free economy. We're going to also have to be looking at everything we can do to protect those reefs that are most likely to survive. And, you know, these are the things that keep me hopeful. I think there's still a chance. We're going to lose a lot. We're going to lose a lot of the world's coral reefs. But, you know, we really need to be protecting as much of it as possible.
Thanks for the work you do. Thanks very much for being on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Always good.
Mark Aiken at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. To the Point, produced this week by Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Sasha Woodruff, Yael Evan-Orr, and Luke Vanderplug. Our technical director is Mike Newport, also Mark Hamilton, our managing producer, Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.